Give you an explanation of at least the first prayer here. Going for refuge is an absolute essential part of the practice of Mahamudra, absolute essential part of any Dhamma practice. And it expresses a direction that we take, a goal for refuge. It's all translations, they say, I take refuge. I don't take it, I go. I commit myself. It's a commitment. And there is the verb to go, to proceed. So I enter in what is safe. Refuge here means safe place. And Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, they stand for that which is truly safe. I go into that direction where I place my full trust. This is the safe direction to take. And this commitment says here, until awakening. So this means complete awakening. It means Buddhahood. It means not a little bit of awakening, a little bit of insight, but a journey, a complete journey of perfecting the paramitas, the transcendent or liberating qualities. So they start later on. They say, by the positive force of the practice of generosity and the other liberating qualities, then I engage. I engage to this practice. But first, I realize that I need guidance, and I open up to guidance, which is very important on the path. We don't walk the path by ourselves because we just don't know, very simply. Otherwise, we would already be free. So if we still suffer, that is clear. We don't know. And the way our teacher and many teachers explain the refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the Supreme Community, is twofold. We always make it clear what is the outer aspect and the inner aspect of the refuge. Buddha, yes, obviously there was a Gautama Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni. Obviously, yes, there are awakened beings. And in the Mahayana tradition, we tend to understand, when we say Buddha, we tend to understand this in the plural. Yeah, all the Buddhas, all the completely awakened ones of all times, not just one Buddha, including all the female awakened ones, no difference. So this is the outer Buddha, and the outer Buddha is called Buddha because of realizing Bodhi, awakening, having completely awakened from the sleep of ignorance. And this is a refuge, because only those who have completely awakened from the sleep of ignorance actually know what full liberation or full awakening means, and they can guide others. Everybody else, every other mind stream in this universe, anyone where there is still the slightest trace of ego-centeredness, attachment, aversion, becoming angry at this, upset at that, you know, having to be pleased and getting displeased, all of those mind streams, as powerful they might be, they are not a true refuge. They cannot be an ultimate refuge because they are themselves caught in samsara. Okay, so the refuge needs to be outside of the mechanisms of self-importance, clinging, attachment, aversion, ignorance. It has to be completely free of that. So in the human realm, we look for such examples, those who are completely free, the completely awakened ones. And that's where the term Buddha applies. Now, when we take refuge to the outer Buddha, we do this with an understanding that that is the inner Buddha. We take refuge at the same time in our potential to be Buddha, to become Buddha. That's the inner aspect. So we take refuge in our own Buddha nature while relying on outer Buddhas in order to guide us. It's a practice of humility, it's a practice of devotion, it's a practice of inspiration. Very important, very, very important. So important that in the preliminaries of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, we do 111,000 prostrations, full-length prostrations on the floor, together with the 111,000 repetitions of the refuge prayer, just to get a little idea of what it means to abandon oneself, to open oneself for blessing, for guidance. It's supposed to be a good practice to begin softening our pride and this I know it all attitude, and you know, like really softening. But usually it doesn't help. Just 111,111 is usually not enough. So mostly we do it more often. I did it 3 times in my life. Yes. And I started when I was still a student in medical school at the age of 24. Yes. Okay. Big, really developing refuge. And the refuge is always in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Now, Dharma also is twofold. There's the outer Dharma and the inner Dharma. Now, the outer Dharma we have talked about already. It's the Dharma of the words, the textual transmission, the hearing transmission, you know, all of what is explained to us. And this Dharma is incredibly valuable. It's an incredible treasure. It shows us the understanding of what is liberation, what is possible for us, and it shows us the means. It shows us the practice. So you can say the Buddha, Buddhahood, complete awakening is the goal, and Dharma is the path. By studying and listening to the Dharma, by contemplating the Dharma, and by meditating the Dharma. And all of this refers to the benefits that we have from the outer Dharma. Very important. Now, outer doesn't mean of little importance, because the outer Dharma reveals the inner Dharma. The Dharmata. Maybe you have heard this word already. The nature of phenomena is called Dharmata. Can also be called Tathata, suchness. There are many words for that. It's revealing the truth of liberation within ourselves. The understanding of the full Dharma lies in our own experience, lies in our own mind, lies in this life that we live. So we take refuge to the Dharma also in this twofold way. Total respect to the outer Dharma and deep veneration for that truth that is to be discovered in ourselves. This is the refuge to the inner Dharma. And as you can already guess, the path through the outer leads to the revelation of the inner. Yeah? So, you know the sutra where the Buddha talks about, you know, when you reach the other shore, you know, crossing over the ocean of suffering or the stream of suffering with a raft, then as you have reached the other shore, you don't carry the raft on your shoulders anymore, because then the Dharma speaks from within you. You don't need to rely on the concepts of the outer Dharma, the Dharma of the words, because now the Dharma of realization is active. Huh? When the Dharma, the inner Dharma, is called the Dharma of realization. The Dharma of realization is actually what we go for, and the outer Dharma is a means, is a help to understand that, to realize that. And then same for the Sangha. The Sangha, of course, is first the community of all those who are either already awakened, completely awakened, partially awakened, or at least completely engaged on the path. They know the path because they are practicing it, or they have already gone the whole path. They are intensively practicing this. Normally, someone who has not realized where the Dharma of realization has not awakened is not considered Sangha as a jewel of refuge. we don't take refuge in the community of those practicing here, because there's too much confusion. Yes, it's not a jewel of refuge. The jewel of refuge needs to already really know the path, has to have a stable realization. But if some dedicated monks and nuns in the earlier days, and nowadays we have these dedicated lay practitioners completely dedicating their whole life, if a group of them gets together, we can maybe take refuge in this group. As a group, yeah, they can be said to have the path of awakening in them. They carry it. They are a guarantee because they hold together. Yeah, they help each other with the lack of understanding. Where one is lacking in understanding, the other man might understand better. But normally Sangha, noble Sangha, means the Sangha of the noble ones, which means the realized ones. That's the outer Sangha. Now we carry in ourselves also the capacity to become Sangha. I wouldn't have dreamt of that when I was, 21 years old, taking refuge, formally for the first time. I drove to Paris and so on, that I would at some point become Sangha was unimaginable, you think it's, but that's the inner potential. And actually, what is the quality that we take refuge in is friendship. Sangha is the community of the teachers, actually, the community of those who are able to show the way. And they do it out of friendship, spiritual friendship. They are Kalyana Mitras. They are friends, Mitras, of that which is wholesome, that which liberates, an incredible quality. It's not the emotional friendship with a lot of attachment, and if things don't go well, then there's aversion and we split up. No, the mitrata, the friendship of the Sangha, goes beyond the personal likings. We are together on the path and we help each other on the path. And we help each other even, when we might not personally want to spend vacation together. Yes? We might not do that. But we help each other from the Dharma point of view. And this capacity to give the Dharma, to share the Dharma, and to help other beings on the path, this is what makes the Dharma continue through the ages. The Asian teachers of these living Asian traditions, they took these crazy Westerners, they took them on as if they were their children, They took them on with friendship and passed on the Dharma. That's why the Dharma is here. Yes. The Dharma has come into so many countries because there were practitioners, and there still are, there are practitioners who consider all human beings, all sentient beings, as the Mahasangha. That means as their family, as their big family, big community. That's another way of using Sangha, means actually everyone is our sister, everyone is our brother, everyone has, is searching for that happiness, searching for that freedom, and we support everybody in that search for freedom. And that's an act of love, and it becomes a real practice because this love, this friendship, doesn't stop even if we misbehave, even if we don't understand, just continues through the ages. And these practitioners have taken incredible difficulties on them crossing mountains, for example, you know, maybe you don't know how difficult it was to cross the Himalayas, to go over from Tibet to India, to bring the Dharma back, you know, like Marpa, one of the founders of the Kaji Mahamudra lineage, he went 3 times across the mountains, forth and back, 3 trips to India, spent 21 years at the feet of the great Mahamudra Siddhas, Naropa, Metripa, and others. And this incredible effort, and then translating it into the mother tongue, you know, like some of you are perhaps involved in translation. So always bringing the treasure of that, what is most precious, bringing that home, bringing that to the Mahasangha, the greater Sangha that one can communicate with. This is the jewel of the Sangha. And the inner Sangha is our love for sentient beings, is our friendship with those whom we meet. And when they talk to us, and we find out they have the same sickness as ourselves used to have, then we share the Dharma with them, because we know it works. And they say, oh yes, I know that fear. Oh yes, I know how it is to be restless. Yeah, I know also how it is to meditate, you know. And they're not good teachers. So we begin sharing, right? We begin sharing the medicine that worked for us. That's friendship. That's, you know, we don't hold back, and that's very natural. So we have this natural friendship in us for everyone who is also sick from samsara and wants a solution. And we offer the solution. At least we indicate where to find it. You know, here, you can go this way, there, you know. There are people who know better than myself, and this is the first, you know, the first action of Sangha. So we have that in us. We have Buddha in us, have Dharma in us, have Sangha in us. And we have the outer Buddha to have the inner Buddha, the outer Dharma to have the realization of that truth which liberates, the Dharmata. And we have that outer example of Sangha, which shows us how to love and how to live friendship in this world without being biased, prejudiced, you know, like really sharing the medicine. What would you say of a doctor if he only treats one group of people and holds the medicine back from other people? Oh, not good, not good. Yeah? So Dharma sharing is always open to everyone who is sick from samsara. So actually, the first act is to ask for the medicine. That's what we do as practitioners. And that's the going for refuge. The going for refuge is Buddha is the doctor, Dharma is the medicine. And my practice is taking the medicine. Okay, applying it. So this act of saying, please guide me, please offer me the Dharma, please help me on the path. Help us on the path, this is the Sangha, right? They will help me. They're around me, those guides. So going for refuge has become the one uniting practice of all those who are on the path of liberation and awakening. It connects all of us across all traditions. It is a very humble gesture of saying, I need help. Yes. Please. Please offer me what's necessary. I will listen and reflect. I will contemplate and I will apply it and know. Get familiar with it, that means meditate. I will do then what's necessary. And then comes the next commitment here. You know, what I've explained so far was until awakening, I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Community. May I, by the positive force, you know, often translated as merit, by the positive force of the practice of generosity, and the other liberating qualities, like wholesome conduct, patience, joyful perseverance, meditative stability, wisdom, the tradition is six parameters, we can add more. Yeah, they're all rooted in compassion and love. So may I, by practicing these heart qualities, realize Buddhahood for the benefit of sentient beings. And that's the commitment. So going for refuge, and then entering the commitment for the benefit of all beings to realize the fruit. So that's a very strong commitment, and it is often repeated by my Mahamudra teachers and Dzogchen teachers and so on. You know, that without this going for refuge and this bodhicitta commitment, this bodhisattva vow, which are the last two lines which I read. Yeah, this is the bodhisattva vow. So without that, Mahamudra will not take fruit, will not bear fruit. It will not be the realization that we hope for. So often they say, and it's often quoted, that the preliminaries, and there are more preliminaries, but that the preliminaries are more important than the main practice. In the understanding of my teacher, a complete going for refuge would open our mind already so much that the realization would dawn in us. So much so. So incredible. You know, just because there is this complete opening, abandoning ourselves. There's so much love and compassion for all beings and trust in this awakened dimension. And then we would say, and then we meditate in the refuge. Okay? Before I always said, let the Buddha meditate in you. But another way of saying the same thing is, let the refuge meditate. Yeah, you understand, it's the same meaning, okay? So I've been giving refuge in the sense of offering the refuge ceremony to many people, many thousands of people. Yeah, it's like something which is very current in my life. You know, it's like in my life of a lama, that's part of the activities. And so I was very attentive to when Gena Rinpoche was offering the refuge ceremony. And there were two special points which he made, which are more than what I said so far. He always said, you are not entering a religion. Going for refuge to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha is not entering a religion. You can stay Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever. There have been Christian priests taking refuge. There have been Muslim practitioners. So many Jewish Dharma practitioners. You don't have to leave your previous tradition. However, you infuse that previous tradition with all the understanding coming from your Dharma practice. And you will see that some of it is not so helpful. Yeah, and it must be understood deeper. But for example, when I heard this morning that the deeper meaning of Shabbat is that at the seventh day of creation, God found this was perfect now, and that we are celebrating the perfection of creation on every Shabbat. And I said, yeah, that's the Dharma. Actually, every day should be Shabbat. Yeah, because there's nothing to improve. All this crazy activity of trying to improve, making it better, you know, this is actually samsara. And hey, everything is okay. Realize the perfection, and then you enter the great perfection. That's the real meaning of Dzogchen, okay? You enter the great perfection. And it is called the all-perfecting timeless awareness. It's that non-dual awareness that sees the qualities of the present experience and knows there's nothing to subtract, nothing to add, just that. And that's a description of awakening, okay? So in that way, you take any teaching, you take it deeper. You take it to its deepest levels, and then we can meet with all the mystics of the world, you know, wherever we meet them, for as long as we speak from experience, then we understand each other. If we speak from views and opinions, we might not understand each other. If we talk from the experience of the heart, everyone knows how beneficial it is to go for refuge. Just give it different names. If it is complete awakening, it will be a perfect refuge. Okay? The complete awakening is very clearly described what is meant by that. It's not vague, it's not an invention and not defined. It's very clear experience of what complete awakening is. So that was the first point he always made, Geno Rinpoche. It's not entering a religion, because it is universal. And he would say, even in other galaxies and other universes, you would always encounter the same spiritual principles of any path, for as long as there is bondage, for as long as there is suffering, there will arise the idea of becoming free. So there will be the goal, complete freedom, complete awakening. There needs to be a path and methods, the Dharma. Okay, Buddha, Dharma. And there need to be helpers on the path. This principle of knowing where one goes, a path to go, and the methods to go the path, and the helpers, this is universal. This is, you will meet this in every galaxy you go to. Just try, you know, see. And it made so much sense to me. Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. It sounds like religion. We project all our difficulties with religion on this. But actually, it's a very simple thing. Very, very simple. And sometimes the Buddha, because he was offering the refuge already in his lifetime. For as much as we know, he started with refuge in the Dharma. Then the refuge in the Buddha, in the awakening, was added. And then very soon, the refuge in the Sangha was added. So by the end of his life, the complete triple refuge was there. And then these sentences that we use in the refuge ceremony, they have continued from that time on. They are the same in the Pali, the same in the Sanskrit, have been translated into Tibetan, into Japanese, and so on. So this universal, non-religious commitment to go, to walk the path for the benefit of all sentient beings. This is the core of the practice. And you could say it already summarizes the full practice. Yeah? It could be very complete if we were to understand all the shades of meaning, all of what is connected, if we really do it. So this is enough for now. I just wanted to explain that to you. In the two things. It's not a religion and it is universal. Yes, that is. And then also he would say that maybe we can add a third thing. He would also say, actually, the ceremony is not necessary. Because often the Buddha, he would just snap with the fingers and say, come, my daughter, come, my son, you know? And with that, even the complete monk ordination or nun's ordination would be given. Yes? No need for many words. But at other times, he would elaborate. Okay? So the simplicity of that is also there. And in every refuge ceremony, there is the snipping of the fingers, because of those moments when the Buddha made it very short. There was no need to talk more. And now I suggest I sing it again. Those of you who like, you can join me. And we sing it with the awareness of the meaning. And then we imagine that Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha dissolve into us. So the Buddhas, or the one Buddha, the Buddhi, whatever, the light, the truth, all the text, whatever, all the CDs, whatever you have, all of that which has the Dharma, you know, all of that dissolves into light. All the words dissolve into us and nourishes the Dharma of realization in ourselves. And as well, all the Sangha, you know, all those wonderful beings, Ananda, Mahamoggallana, Shariputra, and so on, all those original Sangha members and all the rest, you know, they just, we are part of this family and we all receive that blessing as if we were in the presence of the Buddha. Sangye Chedan Sangye Chanam La Janjo Mbado Ndane Kyab Sunchi Dagi Chin Son Chin Pesanam Jin Drola Penche Sangye Jompa Sangye Chedan Sangye Chanam Lan Janjom Vadu Dane Kyab Suji Dage Chin Soi Chin Pesanam Ji Jolam Penche Sangye Jompa Shon Sangye Chedan Sangye Chanam La Janjum Padu Dane Kyab Sunji Dagi Jin Son Jin Pesanam Ji Jolam Penche Sangye Jompa Sho. And the complete refuge dissolves into us and we are filled with light. And we breathe in and breathe out in the light. As if we could breathe in the refuge, and then we share the Dharma, the refuge, with everybody. 20 minutes break. Breathings again and the three retentions. I want to explain you a little bit better than what I could do this morning. Every time you will understand a little bit better. But before, a few sentences about a very important mechanism, you can say, how we learn about adjusting our practice. We alternate two ways of doing. We can say the first one is relaxing. We have been very much into relaxing and opening so far. Yeah, it's like, it's very normal, but it can't go all the time because there is the drowsiness, the torpor, there is like, especially when it's warm outside and so on. And then there is the opposite practice of energizing, tensing, bringing in, creating a greater tonus in your system. Yeah. So when, in the beginning, as we learn to meditate, relaxation is so strong that we quickly enter torpor. And then as we make an effort, it is quickly too strong that we enter restlessness. Yeah, most of us feel that too much effort is worse than too much relaxation. Yeah, so we have many teachers and practitioners who encourage us to rather relax. But actually, that's not the whole story. We have to know how to also give a little tonus to our presence, right? So we can do this through the body. We can do this in different ways by creating more interest in the mind. So the art of tensing and relaxing becomes so subtle that it will, in the end, resemble the flight of an eagle. You know, that's a classical example, huh? The classical example of the Mahamudra tradition, you know, the big wings of an eagle, or you can also take a seagull. They are also extremely good at this. Huh? And it looks as if they are flying effortlessly just with the wind, you know, curving in the wind, gaining height, descending again. Just minimal changes in their wings, and they go where they want. Not so often flapping with the wings. They don't need that very much. However, must know the wings, they have a tonus. There is an energy there. Okay? There is an energy which works with the wind. Yeah? Okay, it's not just they're not, yeah, clear, it's obvious. When I point it out, it becomes very obvious. So when it says effortlessly like an eagle, it doesn't mean complete effortlessness. Like the example of the Buddha with the sitar or with the lute, a string instrument of his time, he would say, well, too much effort makes the string break. No music, too much relaxation, the string also is too soft, no music. We want good music. So what's the good tonus? Yeah? The good tonus. How to find that out? And so we need this practice of tensing and relaxing. And we have very fine means of doing that. Sometimes just a little straightening of the back, little relaxation in the lower pelvic region, you know. All of this, little relaxation, little straightening. Sometimes just by how we place the hands. If we place the hands, for example, a little bit raised, like I do now, you see, my navel is here. And I place the hands below the navel, the thumbs touching, a little bit raised in the air, like often it is being taught in the Zen practice. This little support here, having to keep the hands not completely lying down, but a little bit up, creates a tonus. Yeah. And it straightens actually the back. And then, if I want less tonus, I put the hands on the knees and I relax. Nothing, yeah, nothing to hold on to. No effort to produce. Like this small changes. Opening one leg, keeping one leg crossed, you know, makes a difference already. Then bringing the leg together again. So finding out with the body and finding out with the mind. Now, the exercise we are going to do now, like this morning, is of course in the category of bringing in tonus to the organism. Yeah, it's a pranayama practice. It's very tonifying. It's like giving energy. And it is then followed by a period of just being. You know, after we have done the three retentions, we sit, complete trust and confidence. Nothing to do anymore. So immediately after having tonified, you can say, intensified our, heightened our awareness, there comes the complete, you can say, letting go of all effort. But the after effect of the practice before is definitely noticeable. And we sit in that and we might find out, oh, okay, it's good. We got ourselves into that cleared awareness, and now somehow it continues for a while, and we learn about no effort, how it can be to be clear without any effort. And we use that as a method often in the morning to clear out the dullness, because that's when we need to bring a little bit of energy in our system. Okay, now we go for it. Okay. In a room full like this, I cannot show you the full exercise, Lila, but I will show them up here, but just bring your head out of my reach, yes? Because the full exercise, of course, then is with the 7-point posture. Yeah, that's how we would start, and then we relax, we go like this, we go up here to the chest, and then, yeah, and we turn. But this is, you know, I know some teachers, they show it as if it was a little dance, but this is good for nothing. You know, it is really here a strong clapping on the ribs, and then with the energy of the rib clap, we throw the arm out into this mudra, yeah? And then there's an intense folding inwards of the hand, bending in, and then it circles horizontally towards the nose, okay? So what we do is we go up here at a nadi, an energy, then we open here, the chest at the rib cage, we strike a point here, then we stretch out, and this is the opening of all the nadis here in the arm. Then, as we fold in, we open all the nadis, the energy channels in here. We turn, so you should feel it, yeah. And then we come here, and then only the breathing out through the right nostril starts. Yeah, and we imagine that we breathe out all the tiredness, all the veils, everything. Now, if you feel, do you think you have enough space to be able to do that with me, the full thing? I don't think so. The simple version is simply to go up to the nose. You have your right hand sitting, you know, the fist on your right knee, and you breathe out. Breathing in through both nostrils. then the full version would be to clap down. Okay? That you can do. You're not hurting anybody. Coming up here. So even if you are standing, you can do that with the hand, you know. Next breathing in. The left hand also breathes out, like this. Breathing in. Both fists on the knees, breathing in. You see, I'm just showing for back there, you know, for you. You can have your fists down. As you breathe in, you close them. And then as you breathe out, you open them. Then we breathe in and we go into the retention. We breathe in, maybe 80%, swallow, and we feel the energy below the diaphragm, okay?
Big belly,
no breathing. Now releasing, breathing out. Sitting, just open mind, nothing to do. Perhaps you notice that you still have a tonus in your energy system. You still feel vitalized. And this, this is what we want. The method itself is not the central point. It's this after effect. A natural clarity, very much present and easy. And now I would like to show you again, to finish off with these instructions, this famous seven-point posture of Vairochana, which I mentioned also this morning, because actually the we love Dzogchen, we love Mahamudra and so on, but we are often not aware how much these are yogic practices. And we think we can maybe just take some instructions on the mind, but it was very much, and it is still, a body-mind practice with a lot of working on asana, on, you know, yogas, pranayama, and so on. All of this is very much included. Now, you will not find a Mahamudra book which does not describe the seven-point posture. Okay? So, I showed you this morning, legs crossed in Vajra posture, we call it, the right leg on top, the left leg below. It's like the Padmasana in the yoga, only that it is clear that it is the right leg on top. And then the arms, they are stretched through. Do you see what my elbows are doing? What the hand is doing, I will show you also, but first look at my elbows. That was the question. So the question is, you know, I always thought that my arms were too long, of course, or my back too short, but there was never a problem. You just, when you know, the effortlessness comes from having the elbows turn forward until they rest against exactly that point that we were massaging with the ribhead before, right? So one side and the other side. And I show you the fingers. Fingers are like this. Here, the thumbs at the bottom of the ring finger, the ring finger can bend inside, and then the right hand, the right two fingers on top of the left. And there's just slightly touching because you're using the soft part of your thighs as a support. Now, I'm not going to torture you. I just want to show you. Yeah. The idea is not that you get into all kinds of problems. I also had difficulties with this, but finally this posture helped me to heal my back injury, which I had from sports, you know, from and so on, and it produced lots of good benefits. And my teacher asked me to sit, if possible, the whole day in that posture. I never did more than 3 hours, but 3 hours is a lot, yes? And it shows you how much we work with tonification. Now, when you see that, then afterwards you smile at the very straight Zen posture, which is the one I would maybe advise you to adopt. Not even try. If you can, you seem to be able to do it. We can check with those who feel that their body can still do it. But the others, you put simply your hands together, 4 fingers on top of each other, and the thumbs touching, and you put them close to your body, and then you let them rest down. You know, you don't have to hold them up. Just let them rest down. This is already a tonifying and an energizing posture. It is definitely bringing more energy into the system than the open hand posture with the hands on the knees, right? Maybe you can feel that. So we use this and we sit straight. And sitting straight doesn't mean chin up. Actually, it means here, this place where we had as a child the fontanelle, the opening, this is the highest point. Okay, this is where we have the softest spot in our skull, and this point called the Brahmanic opening, then this is as if attached to the sky. And I don't know where my grandfather got this from, but he always told me, Tilman, walk straight as if you have a golden thread attaching you to the sky. So, but this is exactly the idea. So, which means that the chin is a little bit tucked in, since it is not the center of the head which is highest, but it is a little bit towards the back which is highest. Okay? So, we have the leg posture, and if you can't do the Padmasana, you do the what we call the Bodhisattva posture. You just put the legs in front of each other. They don't have to be on top of each other. You can just put them in front, and of course any posture you like. But it's just giving you the idea what we work with. The back is straight and supple, so flexible. Remember this flexibility there. Then the hand posture, I explained, 4 fingers below the navel, the hands meet. And in case you would have the left leg on top, because that's easier, then you would also change the hand posture. Then it would also be the left hand on top. You always do legs and the feet and hands, you do same. Like you have the right leg on top, so you would have the right hand on top. Okay, and then the mouth is very relaxed. The lips are just barely touching. There's no tension in the lips. We are breathing through the nose. And our teachers used to say, well, in order to be sure that you have your lips really relaxed, see if you could breathe through the mouth. There's maybe a tiny opening. You could if you wanted, but we are breathing through the nose. So very relaxed lips. And the tongue rests against the palate, yeah? It rests inside and against the upper part of our mouth. So these were the first 6 points of the 7-point posture. The last point is the gaze, huh? Is how to look. Now in the normal 7-point posture, which is meant to develop shamatha, we look downwards. When our mind becomes stable, we develop more insight practice, we raise the gaze. And sometimes for specific purposes, we even look a little bit up. Now, since for many of you it's new how to deal with looking, you're not looking onto a spot. You're choosing an area in which the gaze can oscillate. Yeah? You don't fix the eye muscles. They need to be able to relax. We have 8 eye muscles and they need to contract and decontract alternately so that they always remain relaxed. So we just choose an area. The texts say along our nose, but depending of what nose we have, we might end up in the sky or on the ground. So the idea is looking downwards, maybe 1.5-2 meters in front. And the gaze is so relaxed, we are not investigating the characteristics of what we are looking at. We are almost looking through, as if we were looking into a far distance. So in that way, the gaze can remain very, very relaxed. So the Mahamudra, normal meditation postures with open eyes. But then if you feel this is getting too much and you're not used to it, of course, I also meditate with closed eyes. I don't always want to have you in my visual field, you know. It's like, yes, it's fine. I notice a lot, but it's not always necessary to open the eyes, because we are in a much greater resonance. So when with open eyes, we are in a greater resonance to our surrounding. But it also brightens our awareness. There is more light, there is more energy. Yeah? So this brightening is very much asked for. And then to develop the capacity to actually interact by looking with, you know, by looking into the eyes and still continuing to meditate as you look into each other's eyes. Something which psychotherapists, for example, find very helpful, to be able to continue the inner meditation practice while being listening to someone. It's possible to continue the practice, and you need open eyes. Not so good when the therapist begins to, it's like not so helpful. Okay, that was it. That was the little bit explanation of the 7 points of Vairochana. And I know our kitchen team has to leave, and also we need to go into the group, and we will dedicate together. So we will do the dedication prayer. Sunam de yitam jesing panin top nenim pedranam pam jene kegana chim balam jumpaye sim pensun len jovadravasho Jampem pavuntita kempadam kanto sampo de yande shinte denda kunji jesu da lom jeng gewan denda tam jedam tumo Sangye kusum nipen jen lam dan chene minju adem pen jen lam dan gandun mijen dem pen jen lam jin jin dang o vaman lam jumpa shoo.